mention a couple of our sponsors for today. I'm grateful to have Crossway sponsoring the podcast. And want to mention the new book, Everyday Gospel by Paul Tripp. I'm sure many of you have read one of Paul Tripp's books, and this is a great way to get into Paul's writing and also into the Bible. This is a book of 365 fresh, engaging entries following an annual Bible reading plan from Genesis through Revelation. You get brief, practical reflections as you read through the scriptures. So pick up a copy of Everyday Gospel from Crossway. You can sign up for a Crossway Plus account to get 30% off. Also grateful to have Desiring God sponsoring the podcast. This October, join Desiring God to celebrate the heroes of the Reformation by highlighting both well-known figures and lesser-known champions of the faith. There is a 31-day journey through the month where you can read or listen to short little biographies of men and women who defended the Bible, its key truths. There's over 100,000 people who have already subscribed, so go to desiringgod.org/stand. to be a part of this special Reformation tour online through the month of October. Greetings and salutations. Welcome to Life and Books and Everything. I'm Kevin DeYoung, Senior Pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina. I am joined today by my very special guest and truly a friend, and a great scholar, Chad Van Dixhorn, all the way up the road, about 3 miles away in next door Charlotte. Chad, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you. All the better for seeing you, Kevin.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Who is some people watch this, most people listen to it, but right over your shoulder is a picture of a very handsome-looking fellow. Who is that?
That's John Lightfoot. John Lightfoot.
And who was John Lightfoot? Yep. And have you done any work on him? Any books that you could mention?
So John Lightfoot was a member of the Westminster Assembly, a scholar of the Old Testament. And yes, I have done work on John Lightfoot.
I have that book. It is an impressive book.
So last year, OUP published John Lightfoot's journals of the Westminster Assembly. So including a journal that was previously lost and covers a good chunk of the assembly's history, about which, if it were not for this book, we would know nothing. So I'm kind of excited about that.
So say that again. So people have, you found something from Lightfoot that hadn't been found before?
Yeah, I mean, it was known in the late 17th or early 18th century, but then it kind of went missing. So a part of his journals were published in volume 13 of his works, but this, but what was published was incomplete. So I found one more journal. It covers a chunk of the Westminster Assembly's history about which no other information had survived. So it's that's what we call a good day in the life of a PhD student.
So, that's very good. So you found this back when you were doing all your other Westminster
2001,
stuff?
2001, and I finally got it published last year, yeah.
And where, what was it like? Where did you actually find it? And I agree with you. You're much more a bona fide scholar than I am. But when I was doing Witherspoon stuff and in archives, yeah, and I found a couple of things that nobody had, or they were mentioned, but nobody had published before. It is like, you know, an Indiana Jones movie. You feel really excited.
That's exactly how I want people to think about me, as Indiana Jones.
You are the Indiana Jones of the Westminster Assembly, truly.
So is it at Cambridge's library, just bound in with a bunch of other manuscripts, and a librarian knew where it was, but they just didn't know what it was or why it was important. As is often the case, you know, they've cataloged it, manuscript by Lightfoot, and no one had just kind of trolled through volume after volume of catalogs looking for this kind of thing, and so they missed it.
And how easy was it to read his hand?
As 17th century handwriting goes, it's quite good. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. I found volumes of Witherspoon sermons, and I don't think they've been published anywhere in the hand is so difficult, some other student somewhere down the line is going to have to go through them. I did find some things that were readable and were shorter things that I used. And usually, thankfully, presbytery minutes and session minutes tended to be, you know, they knew who they were getting with the clerk.
Yeah.
And he usually did a fairly good job.
Yeah, the Westminster Assembly did not know who they were getting. It's probably the worst hand of the 17th century. But that's the one thing, yeah, I can do is read messy handwriting.
Well, very good. Okay, so I want to get to that, but let's back up a little bit. People, I hope, know you, but it's always good to ask some lead-in questions. Is it true that you come from our fair neighbor to the north?
Indeed. I'm a southerner from a northern country. I grew up in southern Ontario, and spent the first 26 years of my life there.
Near to Michigan?
Near to the land of your heart, Kevin, yes.
Mm-hmm. What city again?
So I grew up outside of a village just south of a little town called St. Thomas. Not sure if it's okay. Named after the apostle or our medieval theologian. Yeah.
Is this on the QEW or the...
No, this is... I grew up one house away from a dirt road. So don't think
really?
Of... And just off the north shore of Lake Erie. So on a foggy
right.
night, we could hear the lighthouse blaring. Yeah.
And did you ever see the lake on fire, or that was before your time?
I did not see, courtesy of America, the lake on fire. Yeah, yeah.
did you grow up a Christian?
I grew up in a church-going home, a conservative Dutch home. Everybody in the church, they're all Dutch immigrants. All of them stuck together by going to church.
What vintage, what immigration pattern was this?
Post-World War II. So my parents grew up in the Netherlands or spent their early years in the Netherlands, came over after the war. My grandfather was a miller, owned a windmill, but between Nazis, flooding the land to get Nazis out, going into hiding and so on, they ran out of money, came to Canada.
And what does, so we're familiar with van and D prefix. What is Dixhorn?
Yeah, anybody's guess. But you know, the best theory I've heard, and I'm going to stick to, is it's sort of from the people who blow the horns on the dykes horns. Huh. Yeah, yeah.
I could imagine that.
Yeah.
So, yes, a blower of the horn. D Young, as you may know, is, I'm told, the most common surname in the Netherlands, because it simply indicates, you know, the firstborn son might get the name of wherever you're from or what the occupation of the father was. And the secondborn son is just, well, what's he? He's the younger.
Yeah.
So you just get De Young. Yeah. So that's all I am. And it allows for lots of comments over the years about, well, now he's De Old. Okay. I have heard it before. So you grew up in a church going home. When did you really get serious about your faith, and when did you get a sense of a call to ministry and or, you know, further studies? How'd you get on the path that you are on?
Yeah, my mother came to a sort of self-conscious, sort of alive Christian faith when I was about 10 years old, really began to pray with us and urge us to consider Christ. I really struggled with assurance of faith for many years. Around 18, my elders had asked me to lead a Bible study called How to Come to Faith in Christ. I really came to understand the gospel through leading that Bible study. Not that I would advise pastors to have someone who wasn't sure if they were a Christian leading Bible studies, but that was very helpful. That's about around when either I became a Christian or became confident that Christ was my savior. I just kept leading Bible studies, and over time realized that there's nothing I loved more than the Friday night or Saturday night Bible studies. So there are enough churches without pulpits that I began exhorting here and there, to use a Presbyterian term, and in a tomato-free environment. You know, no one ever actually kicked me out, although I do respect the churches that never invited me back. My sermons were pretty bad. I eventually talked to my elders, and they said, yeah, we want you to go to seminary. So Then I had to go back to university. So I hadn't gone to university. I'd done grade 13, 2 years of community college. I got one credit for that. One college credit. And then, I went to University of Western Ontario and then to Westminster Seminary. I did a couple degrees there and I was ready for ministry.
So back up a little bit. You said you struggled with assurance. Yeah. Was this personal? Well, obviously it was personal. Yeah. Was this unique to you, or was any of this the elements of the Dutch Reformed Church? You know, Joel Beakey's written lots about this because it can be part of the very serious Dutch tradition that almost discourages assurance as a kind of presumption.
So very much the latter. So it was considered presumptuous for any young person who had not had some kind of pretty remarkable experience to consider themselves a Christian. And indeed, when I went to profess my faith and the church heard about it, all the wealthier donors in the church told the donors that the big givers in the church had told the pastor and the session that if they allowed me to profess my faith, they would leave the church. I was too young, wasn't a solid enough Christian. And they even said, they reminded him that they held the mortgage for his house and they would sell his house the day that he allowed me to profess my faith. And so that's what happened. I professed my faith. 2/3 of the church left that Sunday. They put a for sale sign in his house and sold it, you know, in a flash.
Really?
So, yeah, he moved in with our family because he had nowhere to go. And it was, it's a hard story. The church never really recovered. He ended up over time working in a factory, couldn't do that, ended up pushing, I was going to say grocery carts, but, you know, shopping carts at, I think, Canadian Tire, an establishment that everyone should shop at least once in their life.
So he knew what he was doing. This was a real courageous act on his part.
Yeah. And eventually he slipped on the ice and banged his head and never recovered. So I'm actually dedicating my next book to him. There's a man who just died in obscurity, but he was a courageous pastor. And I sometimes think of what would happen if he had bowed to that pressure and had said to me, yeah, you're actually not going to profess your faith. If he had snuffed out the wick, if you will. Mm-hmm. So an unsung hero, but really my hero. And to be honest, Kevin, you know, he wasn't the sweetest preacher of the gospel. He preached sin better than Christ, but he did preach Christ often enough. And when it really mattered, he came through.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us because this will, if you're not from this really thick old school Dutch Reformed tradition, it all sounds very strange. Yeah. And I grew up in the RCA, but not at all. I mean, the RCA was mainline, very Americanized, had been for two centuries, and all of the waves of Dutch immigrants went into the CRC or in Canada. What was the denomination?
So this
wasn't the CRC.
This for me was the Free Reformed Church, but this little church that fell apart was a church that left the Free Reformed Church and became more conservative.
Right. So I didn't have any of this in my background, but I'm familiar with it and talked to lots of people who had it. Where did this come from?
You know, already in the 17th century, both English Congregationalists and the Dutch Reformed, and then especially in the early 18th century, are beginning to think that the gold standard for a conversion experience, for the gold standard for a profession of faith is a conversion experience. A conscious, I can remember the time, this is what happened to me sort of event.
And sometimes almost wildly supernatural, at least that's what I picked
supernatural's
up.
Supernatural's better.
Some of the
of course it's always supernatural, but
it's always super, but almost like a dream or a vision. Or I encountered that in some of the Dutch circles.
So as a young man, I was desperate for something like that. We would go to people's homes and who had conversion experiences, and I'd listen to them, and you know, my mother would take me around from place to place, and when she had heard about someone who had been converted, and I just wanted one of those experiences, and never quite got anything that dramatic, and that was part of my problem. And then you need an experience like that as well to be called into ministry. Once your standard for church membership or, you know, coming to the Lord's Supper is a memorable conversion experience, you end up with a bunch of follow-on problems, which we talk about in church history at RTS. Sacraments, yeah. Problems, ecclesiology problems. I mean, there's just... You begin to preach a lot about assurance of faith because you've got a church filled with people who've grown up in the church, love the Lord, love his people, but don't have a conversion experience. So there's always shade thrown on their testimony. There's always doubts inculcated. And so kind of accompanying that taxonomy of conversion and membership, you then have a lot of preaching aimed at assurance of faith, because you've got congregations filled with quasi members who lack any assurance.
I didn't even know that as part of your background story. So
yeah.
I'm glad I asked. Maybe you're not glad I asked.
Well, I actually got into the Westminster. I got into studying the Westminster Assembly because of this. I was trying to do an independent study in seminary on assurance of faith with St. Clair Ferguson, who saw that there was no direction or focus to my study, and said, why don't you look at chapter 18 of the Westminster Confession of Faith? And that's how I began really studying the Westminster standards more seriously.
Well, that's a good lead-in. So you were at Westminster. You go right from there to Cambridge?
I had 1 year. So I did the, how do I say this? I did the MDiv and the THM in 4 years, and was too kind of burned out in that fourth year to apply to PhD programs, but had a good sense that the way things were going, I would get into a PhD program. So I just spent a year working for a guy named David Wright, professor in Edinburgh.
Oh yeah,
working on the minutes of the assembly in preparation for a PhD. So it was like a year of my PhD that I didn't pay tuition for, and I did that in Princeton and Edinburgh, and then went to Cambridge. Yeah.
And the dissertation you eventually did at Cambridge, is it the most over the word count dissertation in the history of Cambridge?
So the librarians at Cambridge apparently took the effort to try and figure this out. I think there's a one with more volumes. I don't know if it has more words. This is really not, you know, me figuring this out. They came to me and they were amused when they saw seven volumes arrive in the library.
Yeah. So you did a dissertation that was seven volumes.
I suppose I did. Yes. Yes.
I suppose you did. Yeah. So I know you don't want people to give you accolades, but I think this is just factually true. You are one of, if not, no, you probably are the world's expert on the Westminster Assembly. And what do you do with that? What are you hoping for? However many years the Lord gives you, tell us some of the things you've already done, and now what are you hoping to do with this expertise? Because you only can if we're doing a fantasy football team, I'm drafting you number one for, you know, the Westminster Assembly slot.
You know, one of the ways in which one becomes the world expert is you just keep studying the same thing and everyone else retires. And by default, you become the world's expert. So that's where I am.
Yeah.
Much of the dissertation's now published in the Minutes and Papers of the Westminster Assembly. So that's a five volume.
The most expensive book I've ever purchased.
I am trying.
By myself.
I am trying to. I'm in the process of asking OUP to release these volumes to another publisher to create a paperback edition that will be more affordable.
Wow. Yeah.
But it is appallingly expensive.
It was $800 when I bought it, and I wrote all in there.
It's climbed northward from there. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I got in while the going was good.
Little did you know.
Little did I know.
So that's on the kind of the academic side. Then on the theological and more popular side, I've written a book called Confessing the Faith. My wife's written a wonderful study guide to that. That's designed to kind of lead people through the Westminster Confession of Faith and to really explore what the assembly is saying, not just what this text makes me think of, and to demonstrate from mostly from the texts that the Westminster Divines themselves use why the Reformed faith is plausible as expressed in this confession, and then also to ask the question, kind of, so what? How does this impact my life, my prayers, my ministry? So there's that sort of threefold angle there to confessing the faith. And then back on the academic side, I wrote a little book called You Are Asking What I Did on the Assembly, right? So I'm not rambling unnecessarily.
Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
Okay, so I wrote a book called God's Ambassadors. This is like a historian attempting to do practical theology. So why did the Westminster Assembly examine 5,000 ministers? What were they looking for?
Oh, I don't have that word.
Yeah. What are they looking for in a preacher? How did they try and change the way the Church of England examined, ordained, used pastors, and so on? And so the first half kind of tells that story, and the last part kind of looks at the writings of the Westminster Divines to say kind of what's the theology and the exegesis behind their ideal pastor or their vision of that. So what else, Kevin? I suppose then John Lightfoot and then introductions to different books and lots of articles. So
okay, yeah. We're going to get to this new book that RHB has published. I want to go back to the Confessing the Faith. Yeah. I mean, I have it. I've used it. I forget the exact title, but that's the title.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's the main title. And then
so the commentary on the Westminster Confession. There are lots of commentaries out there over the years, yeah, and lots of good ones. But I do want to encourage anyone out there this is the best current one. We want to learn from other good ones that have come before. And what you said was really important, Chad. You said not mainly, hey, what does this make me think about? And somebody could do that. All right, the Westminster Confession talks about justification, and here's a nice devotion on justification and what it means to me, and that could have some value. But you're really trying to, with application, but you're trying to say, what were they meaning to communicate? Yep. What were they saying? So this is very readable. Nobody out there should be intimidated because you've done some seriously intimidating work. But you're a very good writer, even in those things, and your humor and personality comes through. But this is a really wonderful book that I would say every Presbyterian should have. And I don't say the every lightly. It's very good. And you've worked with Crossway in doing some editions of Reformed confessions, and then there's a Bible that has them in the back. That's really useful too.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by the attention Crossways, by all the attention they're giving to creeds and confessions, and thinking about how this enriches our devotional life, keeps us in touch with Christians through history and around the world. And so, yeah, I've done a few things with Crossway. Yeah.
So let me ask you about the Westminster Assembly. It has often seemed to me, and now I have the expert on here, that in one sense, the Assembly was more successful than they could have dared to dream. That centuries later, people all over the world in hundreds of languages are studying it. It's the standards for denominations all over the world. Probably wouldn't have dared to dream that. And on the other hand, for the immediate context of what they were trying to do in the realm, you might say their work was kind of a failure. If that's the case, how do you explain both of those? And in particular, the second one, which can be a surprise. Even here, when I will teach, and usually now Tom Grossema, who does a great job in our new members class, does on the Westminster, I will tell people, you know what? There may be more Presbyterians in Christ's Covenant this Sunday than there are in England, which is a shock to people. What happened?
Yeah, that's a long story. I mean, the success is due to Scottish adoption and adoption in Ireland, and then emigration, missionary success. The failure has to do with it's it's a long story, but a lot of it has to do with toleration. The Presbyterians at the Westminster Assembly were not willing to make space for Congregationalists, for Episcopalians, and I mean that was the air they breathed. No one made space for one another. They right. really wanted one version of the faith, the Protestant faith, to obtain. And when that soured people in the 40s, when people got a taste of freedom in the 50s, when Episcopalianism returned with a vengeance in the 60s, that combination of things left Presbyterians unable to mm-hmm. ever kind of gain their vision again. So most of them, many Presbyterians, I should say, conformed, went back to the Church of England. Some of them, of the Westminster Assembly's generation, stayed firm to the faith remained Presbyterians, but they did not have educational institutions. They didn't have the libraries they once had. They didn't have the Norman structures on street mm-hmm. corners. They lost a lot of credibility, and then they lost theological credibility at the end of the century. There was a move towards latitudinarianism and even early Unitarianism.
Already by the end of the 17th
century.
Huh.
Yeah, and that's a complicated story. There's still surviving Presbyterians, but over time, church mergers, especially in the 20th century, mm-hmm. further diluted their testimony. The United Reformed Church in England absorbed a lot of Presbyterians. The United Reformed Church in North America is a very happy thing. It's a thriving, Bible-believing Reformed denomination. In the URC, mm-hmm. there are some, believing congregations and pastors, but they are on the decline. So it is a story. There are 19th century, there are early 20th century Presbyterians still in the UK, mm-hmm. in England, but those numbers just keep decreasing, due to.
And you and I have lots of friends who we just want to make yep. clear, who are doing really yep. good work, and yep. we encourage them in the IPC and others.
And the EPCEW, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church of England and Wales, that's quite a mouthful.
Yeah, the EPQ, yep. and yep. yeah, yep. And of course Scotland and Ireland are different stories.
Indeed.
But we're yeah. yeah. So there's good things. It's but the barely the size of a man's fist. Yeah. But we pray for all of the Lord's blessing upon
yeah.
it. What in your decades now of study on the Westminster Assembly. I don't want to say what have you learned, because you've learned 10,000 things, but are there one or two things in particular doing the dissertation maybe that you just really surprised you, or that rank and file Presbyterians would really be surprised to know about the Assembly?
Yeah, I suppose the depth of the doctrine, the conversation about the Westminster Assembly has long been about church government. Those are the most public debates, the most sort of noisily disputed issues mm-hmm. between Congregationalists and the Presbyterians, especially. I think on that front, the debates with Parliament were probably undertold that story. The way in which the Assembly really fought back against a domineering control on the part of Parliament. So there's that story that's interesting, and then I think. It's also the case that the divisions between Presbyterians and Congregationalists don't really help you understand the other conversations at the Westminster Assembly, mm-hmm. such as debates about the doctrine of God, debates about justification, and so on. Just having those two party labels, if you will, don't help you understand any of the other debates in the Assembly, where things fall out very differently. And so I think I've put a little bit of effort into trying to expand those stories and kind of complicate the narrative a little bit.
Are there any myths or part of the received story that you found out maybe that isn't
yeah,
quite as
no.
accurate? Were the handful of Scottish commissioners like the superheroes,
yeah,
or
yeah.
was that slightly exaggerated?
Yeah. So the a lot of the history of the Westminster Assembly has been told by Scottish historians and by Americans who love Scottish historians. And we do right now. But those narratives tend to lionize the Scottish contribution in ways that that reflect the prominence of an Alexander Henderson, a Samuel Rutherford, a George Gillespie, but that also minimize mm-hmm. the narrative of some pretty impressive English theologians. So there's another part of the narrative that we're trying to correct, and we're publishing. I'm involved in trying to bring to the fore some more works of English theologians, such as John Arrowsmith, as well as helping us better understand our Scottish theologians. So that narrative needs to be enriched, if you will, by a discussion of English theologians. That's one of the reasons why I went to Cambridge to study, to look at the contributions of the English. And then, on a kind of popular level, there's a pretty persistent narrative promoted by editors on Wikipedia that there were Baptists at the Westminster Assembly. I've got Presbyterians who kind of, correct the narrative. No, there are Congregationalists, but not Baptists. And then someone will just kind of work that story back into the Wikipedia page on the Westminster Assembly.
So no Credo Baptists at
no
the Westminster Assembly.
No Credo Baptists at the Westminster Assembly.
Anyone who was there who then later became Credo Baptist.
And that also is a no. Yeah, yeah. So that's sort of amusing. In August, I was speaking to a group of Baptist ministers and had to remind everybody that most of them did know this. There were no Baptists at the Westminster Assembly, and we love you anyway. Yeah.
We do love you. And then they can, the London Baptist Confession, feel free to just use our confession. Make a few emendations and it's yours.
And the Westminster Assembly loved Baptists as long as they didn't print too much about their views.
Some things never change. Let me mention a couple of other sponsors who are grateful to have Reformation Heritage Books, RHB. I want to mention again Puritan Treasures for Today. This is a series of books that RHB has put together. It is giving the best of the Puritans with some updated language, helpful introductions. There's classic works from people like John Owen, Jeremiah Burroughs, and many more. So this is a great way to get into the Puritans, or if you found the Puritans a little bit challenging, or you have someone in your life who's maybe intimidated by them, you can go to Puritan Treasures for Today that RHB is putting out, and it's a wonderful way to get into all that the Puritans have to teach. And if you go to heritagebooks.org, coupon code CLEARLY, you can get an additional 10% off. Also grateful for Westminster Theological Seminary and their partnership with this podcast. At WTS, you can get a 100% online biblical language certificate program. So if you are looking to grow in your knowledge or just start out learning Greek or Hebrew within a couple of years and be able to read the Bible in the original languages, you can go to wts.edu/language and begin working on this language certificate program to help you, whether you're a pastor or student, just want to know the Bible better, how to learn Greek and Hebrew for yourself. So you mentioned John Arrowsmith, a new book that has come out by RHB, and really grateful for RHB to publish these old works like this. And this is the first time that this has been published, or in hundreds of years at least?
That's right. So there's a couple 17th century, well, I guess one 1668, another 1700, but then David Noe produced a fantastic translation. I had the privilege of introducing it, and you were kind enough to puff it and say something nice about it.
I did puff. So here it is. It's a big book. Plans for Holy War, How the Spiritual Soldier Fights, Conquers, and Triumphs by John Arrowsmith. It is, 500 pages here, and I did give it a good power read and enough to give an honest blurb for it. I have to admit, I think I'd heard of him. I'm not familiar with him. You have an excellent introduction. Introduction is actually selling it short. Chad's introduction in this book is like two Kevin DeYoung books. Maybe three Kevin DeYoung books. It is a serious introduction. So tell us something. Immediately, people, you know, want to ask, did dude look like a lady or some kind of other Aerosmith?
Yeah.
But different Aerosmith.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was this man, John Aerosmith?
Yeah, he grew up in Eastern England. I had his, believe it or not, had his eye shot out. One of his eyes shot out with an arrow.
In the Civil
as
War?
A young boy. No.
Oh, as a okay.
And he went to Cambridge on a scholarship. He got did well enough that he was able to stay on as a fellow, in which case he did a little bit of teaching and a whole lot of reading. Back then, fellowships were really for the fellow. Actually, that's still largely the case, rather than for the students. He then went to serve as a pastor at a chapel in the county of Norfolk, King's Lynn. But chapel is a bit of a euphemism. It's one of the biggest churches in England. Massive place, very well connected with people around Europe. Then was displaced because of the Civil War, ended up in England, ended up in London, and was called to the Westminster Assembly as one of its theologians. I wrote the whole biography about how he goes from there to Cambridge, serves as the master of St. John's College, beautiful college, then the master of Trinity College, Oxbridge's most wealthy and large college.
Hmm.
One of my research assistants asked me what we know about his family. I said, yeah, the authorities say we know nothing about his family. He says, are you sure? So I started doing my own digging. Turned out there's a lot you could find about his family. There's a will, names all the family members who survive, all kinds of birth, baptism, marriage records, and so on. And he had a really hard life. Married, lost all the children but one from his first marriage, got remarried, further deaths, and so on. But he was a good family man, loving father. And it just helped kind of fill out the biography. In a wonderful way. So thanks to her for her pressing me. Not the first time a research assistant has pressed me, and that's been productive.
And so what is this massive book about, Plans for Holy War? Because, you know, I say in my blurb here that it is a very unique book. It's, spiritual warfare in the life of the Christian, equal parts creative, daunting, intellectual, inspirational, challenging, comforting. He's doing a lot of things.
He really is. It is a truly astounding book. This man is dying. He's unable to give the lectures that he wants to his college. I think he's pulling off just a couple last lectures, maybe to the university, but he's dying. And rather than perfecting the different books that he has well on its way towards the press, he decides to write an entirely new book. So that itself is just challenging. And not a new book, you know, like not an easy book like Confessing the Faith, where you got like a text and you're commenting on it, or like a like a biblical commentary where like the organization is not an issue because you're commenting on text. No, this is just a book that carries through one big theme, that is how spiritual warfare is characteristic of the whole Christian life and, in fact, helps us as a theme to understand the whole of the Bible. So he starts with the Proto-Evangelion, you know, that earliest gospel promise there in Genesis 3, and runs us through right to heaven. The first part is all about spiritual warfare, how Christ is our captain, very Christ-centered, and it's just an encouragement for us to take spiritual warfare seriously, and an argument, Kevin, that spiritual warfare is not just sort of an internal struggle against sin, but a struggle against Satan, and that Satan's main emphasis is to deceive us, to get us wrong in our thinking, our theology, and thereby get everything else wrong downstream. So very interesting argument. Second part of the book is an exposition of Ephesians 6 and the warfare, just covering a number of important doctrines along the way. And the last part's on prayer in heaven, and it's heavenly. It's really, really wonderful. He's a gossipy kind of writer. He tells you how he's feeling, tells stories along the way, loves telling stories along the way, and he does a lot of systematic theology in a very kind of chatty, friendly way, does a lot of apologetics in a much less than usual grumpy way. I mean, he's just much less grumpier than many other apologists. And it's just a really compelling figure.
Do you have a sense for the reception of a book like this? When I see a book like this, which is long and daunting, even though it has these chatty elements to it, I wonder, are we not as spiritual? Are we not as intellectual? Or is it the case that when he wrote it, many people didn't read it then either because it was so big?
So the preface to the 1700 edition says, you know, here is a reprint that's wildly overdue. Everybody's trying to buy this book. It's super it's super costly because, you know, the price is way up there. That theologians and pastors just really value this. So I'm guessing it had a sizable print run from the University of Cambridge when it was first printed. You know, these are theologians in the Netherlands saying, look, this book is just so valuable. It's a book that starts out heavy with these speeches against the Wegelians. And you got to get past that to get to Plans for Holy War, in which case you're really into some rich stuff. A pastor recently said—
And who are the Wegelians?
Who knew? So they are followers of a little-known 16th century errorist, maybe heretic. They downplay the importance of theological education, and they are kind of like 17th century, 16th century charismatics who are downplaying the importance of study of the Bible in favor of direct revelation. But Arrowsmith is really going at them for the way in which they weaken the church by telling people they don't really need to know theology, and by telling ministers they don't really need to study theology. And that is this theology professor's big concern.
Let me ask from this book personal pastoral question. You know, as we're recording this, it's recently in the news that a noteworthy church figure is out of ministry because of personal sin and moral failing, and you and I unfortunately could think of others, good men or seem to be good men in our circles. So we don't need to talk about those specific cases, but are there things that John Arrowsmith, certainly he did say, but what can we glean from this, because a really robust reformed work on spiritual warfare, what insights does he have for the Christian pastor, but really anyone out there in fighting these kinds of sins and struggles, which I don't know if it's happening more often, or we just, the internet lets us hear about it more often. I think that's maybe the case, but certainly we have to be engaged in spiritual warfare in a way that I think we overlook.
So what Arrowsmith does for me as I read this book as I have read and reflected on this book again and again, he's helped me stay on theme with the challenges and the depths of our spiritual warfare in a way that sort of a single sermon or two, you know, John MacArthur's commentary on Ephesians 6 or whatever, you know, Lloyd-Jones or whatever, you get studies that keep you on topic there for an hour or so. But Arrowsmith manages to keep you on this topic for a couple hundred pages without wearying you, without getting repetitive and redundant, which allows you to think about the topic much more seriously. He also is not one of these guys who's content to kind of frown and grimace and warn about spiritual warfare and then not have an even stronger reminder of who our captain is and what our supports are and the help. So, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've heard a lot of spiritual warfare talk that is not evenly balanced when it comes to the comfort and encouragement of how we're going to actually survive in this. And so, but both in terms of the warning of Satan's wiles and a sense that we really don't need to live defeated lives as Christians. We don't need to live with the sense that we are all going to be failures. Aerosmith's really helpful with that. And when you just take a body blow like we have this past weekend and just hearing about another failure, I think we would do well to think more seriously about the spiritual warfare, and we do well to see how in Christ there really is hope for pastors and for everyone else.
That's really good. One of the other topics that he talks about is in this whole realm is a lot of church state ideas. And what did he say? And I think this is an area where, as much as you appreciate this whole book, you differ with some of his assumptions on church state. So give us Aerosmith and then give us Van Dixhorn.
Yeah. In fact, let me give you a threefer rather than a twofer. In the last couple of things I've worked on, I'm trying to honestly represent people I disagree with. So John Lightfoot is an Erastian.
Would he own that label?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. He's going to defend that. That's a good question. Would he own the label? He's definitely defending all the content and sort of the Erastian heroes, if you will. So I'm thinking so, but your question causes me to pause.
And what's your give for people who don't know Erastianism, the one sentence definition?
So an Erastianism is someone who has thought through one of the two default positions of the medieval church. In the medieval church, you've got those who want the state to dominate over the church, and you've got those who want the church to dominate over the state. But there's not a lot of sort of theory behind the state domination view. So William of Ockham is just sort of grumpy, rails against the papacy, but doesn't provide reasons why the emperor should be kind of number one in over the church in Europe. 16th century, you have this is not one sentence definition. This is a story leading up to a one sentence definition.
I like it. I like it.
In the 16th century, you finally have people offering some real kind of exegetical support for that commonly held medieval view, and the Erastian believes that the state has the right given to it by Christ, given to it by God, to determine what the government of the church will be, and secondly, the state is the final arbiter of all cases of church discipline. Or in some cases will affect the discipline itself, but is usually just at least the final arbiter. So Erastianism believes the church, not the state, determines the form of the government, which is in itself indifferent and can be argued for on pragmatic grounds, and is the final arbiter. That's Lightfoot. That's different than John Aerosmith. John Aerosmith, like the vast majority of Westminster divines, would say no, the state has the right to establish a biblical form of church government and is not to be involved in discipline, in church discipline, but can, if you will, echo or independently corroborate the church's discipline. Mm-hmm. And that's what New England Congregationalists believe. That's what most reformers, most people at the Westminster Assembly believe. They believe in an established church, but not an Erastian church.
Right. And these conversations, as we know, are, I think 15 years ago, it would have thought, well, that's an interesting bit of historical retrieval. Yep. And now it's a very live issue with a number of people saying, you know what, that is the Reform view, and they were right, and we ought to have that. Now, in parentheses, I'm never quite sure that there's a plan how we're ever going to get there. unless it's postmillennialism, blah, 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 we get there. Yep. So leave that aside. Just, you know, examining the theology and the theory of it, it is important. Yep. This has become a big thing. How do you assess the thing, and how do you assess Aerosmith and some of these assumptions from the 17th century?
Yes. Yeah, so two buckets of answers. I could wear two hats here. So if I'm wearing my historian's hat first, maybe, I'd say that this is a view that's contested at the Westminster Assembly, believe it or not. Even though
this view being what Aerosmith said,
the view that the church ought to be established, has a sort of a softer and a harder form, and its harder form includes the idea that the state will coerce those who teach, at least teach, otherwise. So it would
some suppression of heretics,
suppress heretics, suppress error as well, degrees of error. Mm-hmm. That there's dissent at the Westminster Assembly that's not successful over this point. Then, as you know, we get into the Presbyterians in America never seem to be big fans of this view, and so already in 1729. The majority of, if not all, Presbyterian pastors in America dissent from the view that the state has a coercive power, that the Presbyterian Church ought to be established. That's formalized in 1788. That's printed in 1789, and so on. So the idea that, you know, a sort of a properly reformed person will side with the English Presbyterians, with Calvin, and not with the American Presbyterians, it strikes me as a quirky on a couple different points. First of all, it's a little out of touch with the situation of the Reformers. The Reformers are not arguing for this. It's just that it's the mm-hmm. air they breathe. And, you know, trajectory arguments can be a little bit dodgy, but let me make one anyway. Most of the Reformers are actually inheriting, if you will, an Erastian situation where the state wants to establish what form the government will be, and they want to dominate that church mm-hmm. and be the final appeal. They want the state to be involved in church discipline. That's the kind of the late medieval situation. As states, especially cities, become unhappy with the church, they're actually beginning to take on themselves church discipline.
Calvin had to fight tooth and nail.
So Calvin's actually fighting against that. And so to say he's for establishment, yeah, that's true. He does believe in establishment, but that's if you will, he's fighting against a worse form of mm-hmm. of establishment, that is Erastianism. And so if the Reformers are, if you will, dialing back on their present situation, and the fact that in a later century, Presbyterians will further dial back, need not be seen as an aberration, but as something that just becomes more possible as political situations change. I'd like to hear more of that discussed and thought about in circles promoting the establishment principle.
Because it tends to be Calvin, Turretz. We got this whole there 16th, 17th century. The capital, our reform position is this sort of without a historical context, without change, and anything different than that is a capitulation to the spirit of the age.
And everybody admires the French Reformed Church as well in the 16th, 17th century. They're not fighting for establishment. They're fighting for freedom. And no one thinks less of them for that. So again, you know, is it the dominant position? It's certainly a major position, but there are those who are not able to get there, who don't even seem to be trying to get there.
And the Dutch have, from the beginning, they have, for better or worse, they have a different view. The Dutch have always been, you know, toleration. They have waves where it's more or less of that. And you might say we see the bad side of it, but because of their experience under Spain, at least they were more willing earlier than others to speak of toleration.
Earlier. I mean, I do think that originally toleration is seen as a uniquely Arminian view for about 50 years. And then eventually the Calvinists kind of get on board with toleration. And they're ahead of the English sometimes. Yeah.
So that was one bucket, history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's one bucket, history. And then obviously the much more important reason to reject, this is now Van Dixhorn giving you his take here, to reject the establishment principle, has to do in the first place with, I suppose you'd call it a kind of redemptive historical or biblical theological point. And that is, the church is Israel. The church is the continuation of Israel or the new Israel. But it's not, but one has to say, not just, how does the church relate to Israel, but Israel when or Israel where? And if you read the New Testament, you read 1 Peter, you read the examples cited in Hebrews. The church is Israel in the wilderness or Israel in exile. We're not Israel in the promised land. The analogies, therefore, the biblical historical or the biblical theological analogies between the church and Israel is not the church and King David, King Hezekiah, King Josiah, or even Ezra Nehemiah. Our parallels are the church in the wilderness, still wandering, looking forward to the promised land, or even better.
Or the church in Babylon.
Even better, the church in Babylon. We are the church in exile, waiting for our 70 years to end before we go home. The church is scattered throughout the lands with governments that may show a tolerance to the Christian faith or may not. But the establishment principle, it makes the biblical theological mistake of assuming too much continuity between Israel in the land rather than Israel in exile.
Let me ask one.
Yeah.
You got more to say?
Well, I do, but people might like a breather. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, here's a follow-up because you and I are on the same page of this. And are you going to publish the talk that you gave at RTS for your convocation? Or is that so much your chapter in the Westminster Confession book, we just have to wait with bated breath?
So Reformed Faith and Practice is going to publish this. There's enough that's distinct in this. In the lecture that you refer to, that I've, kind of worked it into an article.
So look for that coming sometime soon in the RTS online. Yeah. The rejoinder I've gotten from people, now I've gotten some that are not really very thoughtful, but some are. And one of the quick ones, more of a historical argument, is, well, yes, but okay, the American Presbyterians, maybe they changed some things, but look at how much they want to defend Sabbath laws. Mm. And isn't that they still want to enforce both tables of the law? Now, I don't think that's the best way of putting it, but it certainly is the case. They are very exercised over the desecration of the Sabbath, and they want the state to have Sabbath laws. I have a way to think about that, but I'm more curious, how do you understand that? I don't see that as I see that as separate from the establishment. It could be related to it. I mean, you could say, because we have an established church, we have this. But I could see how you don't have an established church, and you still argue as a Christian that this is best for our society, that we don't allow Sunday businesses and commerce.
Yeah.
So I don't see it as a defeater argument, but I'd love to get your response to it.
So first, this may feel a little ad hominem, but I know that some of the people who are really lobbying to recover reformed political structures, if you will, are not actually that keen on practicing reformed, if you will, sort of weekly structures. There are those who really love the idea of recovering a coercive state, who are not themselves that keen on observing the Lord's Day. So there's a bit of an irony there. Uh-huh. Leaving that aside, with you, I think that we can make incredibly strong prudential arguments, common grace arguments, natural law arguments in favor of Sabbath keeping. And as a creation ordinance, I think we ought to do that for all creation ordinances. Mm-hmm. Whether our forefathers were right in wanting to enforce Sabbath laws for the state, I think is one question, but certainly one does not. I don't think one needs to have an establishment principle as one's major tool for enforcing the Sabbath. I'd say the Sabbath is a very important idea. The idea of a work and rest paradigm is really important for humanity. It is for our good that God gave us this. But boy, establishment's a very big hammer for that size of a nail, even if it is a big nail. And I think there are other ways of driving that point home, if you will. So,
and I think that the arguments, at least in the 19th century, which is where I would be more familiar, and it's different certainly back in the Puritans, but those arguments on the American soil are less about, you know, cracking down on, you know, collecting firewood on the Sabbath or something. The issue was, is the post office going to deliver on the Sabbath? Is the government exercising these functions on the Sabbath? Hey, we have a say over what our government does. We don't think the government should be doing this on the Lord's Day. So even when we talk about Sabbath laws in the 19th century, or it may be laws for this municipality that businesses should not be open, that even is different than cracking down in a punitive way on those who, you know, the state is now adjudicating what sort of activity is deemed, you know, recreational or not on the Sabbath. That's not the sort of crackdown that I see in the 19th and 20th century as these debates are happening.
And for what it's worth, to get out of the historical realm, there are two different kinds of arguments for how Christians ought to view the Sabbath. There's the sort of the Harry Reader approach, which was to say, if only a minority of Christians would start saying no to sports on Sunday, would start saying no to X, Y, and Z, you know, it's been proved that a vocal minority can always have a big impact, and we can challenge our culture and help restore some level of sort of Christian hegemony in society by advocating for the Sabbath. The other approach I might call the John Mether approach. He has a wonderful little essay in New Horizons from who knows how many years ago, where he argues that the Sabbath is part of the life of a pilgrim people traveling through this world. It's our kind of cultural statement. So those are two different ways of promoting the Sabbath, if you will. And I think both of those can be traced in our own tradition.
I said I wouldn't keep you past an hour, but I want to ask one other question, which is totally different from Puritans Westminster Assembly. Well, not totally different, because they would care about this too. But one of the things I've really been impressed with, and we're grateful that Chad and his family moved to Charlotte, and Chad is teaching at RTS, of course, and wonderful family, and we've gotten to know you, so I can call you a colleague and a friend. Amen. I'm very grateful for that. And you have given me lots of personal encouragement. I thank you for that very meaningfully so. And everyone who knows you knows that you and your wonderful bride really have the gift of hospitality. I'm going to put the soapbox under your feet now to talk to Christians. Why is hospitality so important? And in your own life, is this something, you know, you think you have a natural affinity for anyways? Or have you had to teach yourself to do this? Because I'm always hearing about all the students who are coming over, and you meet somebody at church and they're having lunch with you. It's really wonderful. So talk about the importance of hospitality in your own life and for the Christian.
Yes. So my parents exercise hospitality in a kind of radical way. They would have, a guy moved in, he had a need, and he ended up staying for 8 years, I think. More than once, they took our family room and divided it in half, just put up a wall and had people living in our house. It was a one-bathroom house for most of my life, and we had 6 to 9 of us in the house. So they exercised radical hospitality. My wife and I do something much more subdued than that. A, we have a bigger house with more bathrooms. And B, although we—
You have a big dog, too.
We do have a horse-sized dog.
Stay away from the dog. Enough said.
We've had people stay with us for a couple of years or so, but never on that scale. But Emily, I guess early on in our marriage, we both do love people. We love students, and we'd have fellow students and people from our church over, and we just started small, lots of food put into the oven and pulled out of the oven and served, little groups for Sunday lunch, and then people over after the Sunday evening service, and Emily just kind of kept it up and became a better and better cook, better at sort of guesstimating how much food works for how many people, and I've been involved just in kind of helping tidy the house, vacuum, clean up dishes, and we've really found that that showing hospitality is at the very least good for our marriage. Sometimes we can get involved in sort of conflicts or issues like that, and just looking outside of ourselves, not always analyzing ourselves or entertaining ourselves. It's just been good for our marriage. And then I suppose, you know, this works in part because of my wonderful wife. This also works in part because our children have decided that they like this. They like having people over. Mm-hmm. And being a pastor in Cambridge and being in Cambridge for 7 years, lots of lonely people, lots of students who don't have a home. Mm-hmm. And the Bible says a lot about strangers, people who can't give back, and showing hospitality to them. So we showed a lot of hospitality to strangers, students and people traveling through town. And we just, the Lord has enabled us to continue to have victims who will say yes when we ask them to come over. So Emily and I do try and look for homes that are close enough to where we can work, the Lord willing, or worship, where we can have people over, a few extra bedrooms,
it's wonderful.
Dining room that's good size. We're very grateful for the way the Lord's provided.
And there are different ways that people can exercise hospitality. Yep. And there are different seasons, yep, depending how, you know, you got nursing kids, you got, there's yes, lots of different seasons for it. And some people, it will be a very formal, like we're getting a date on the calendar, yep, you're coming over, we're bringing out the fine china. Yep. That's not my personality, yep, but I don't want to say that's wrong. But I do think, sometimes less bother is actually more welcoming.
Absolutely.
To people.
Yeah, we do a lot of paper plates and hot dogs. Yeah.
Yeah, and somebody
which you would like,
here at the church.
Way.
I like hot dogs. I can't eat the buns anymore. And I really like paper plates. But somebody said recently about us, which I think was a compliment. They said, yeah, if you try to get on the DeYoung's calendar, their life is so crazy, they might not get back to you. But if you just drop by unannounced, they might just let you live in their spare bedroom, which is sort of, I think, what our life is like right now. Would you say it's a fair deduction or one possible application, therefore, just thinking of pastors, that a pastor ought to try to live close to the church that he's serving in the community? Now, a community, that's a vague term, and it can mean many things in different places, but he ought to live, relatively speaking, close to the church, and therefore the church ought to pay him a salary that allows him to do so, because most churches don't have manses anymore. I do think this hospitality command for elders does have some practical ramifications for how pastors and churches think about ministry.
I love that leading
question.
Disagree.
I'm leading it, hoping that you agree.
But, you know, when we came to Charlotte, you were the first to invite us over, by the way. You were the first to show hospitality.
We had hot dogs.
And we had hot dogs, as it happens. Yes, I think it's a really important aspect to a pastor's ministry, an elder's ministry. I had a thought. It's slipping away, as thoughts sometimes
where the pastor
do.
Lives.
Yeah,
how the church allows that. That bring the thought back.
Not yet, unfortunately.
Okay, you'll dance around it. I know when we moved. I'll just talk a little bit, and then maybe it'll come back. But again, I don't think it's automatically wrong that a pastor might. You know, okay.
Oh, I got it.
Dream was to live in the country, yeah, when your church is, yeah, here, yeah. But certainly, I think if a pastor moves to a church and quickly is somewhere in a different community, far outside, maybe you can do it after you've been there 15 years and people know you and get it. But even then, it's hard to do. I think it is part of the calling that a minister must feel. I'm going to live in this place, and therefore, especially in cities, the church is really going to have to think about how can we make this possible if we really want to, you know, give any sort of effort that the ministry in this city radiates out of the city.
Our forefathers definitely emphasized the importance of a pastor being resident among his people as much as possible. In New York, where costs are prohibitive and where you have a metro and everyone's used to traveling, you can perhaps show hospitality and not live right near the church. But even then, to be close is such a gain. And here's a kind of a quirky reason. You mentioned earlier a minister's failing. Others will come to our minds. I do think that a pastor who has an open home where people are in his home, not just enjoying his hospitality, but by default also observing his life, the way he interacts with his wife and children and so on. I think it becomes harder for a pastor to have a ministry of manipulation, an unfaithful relationship with his wife, an abusive relationship to his family when he lives in a glass house, when people can come by and see him. I think that many of the ministerial failures are accompanied by closed homes where the minister's not known. His family is isolated from the church. And so hospitality, I think, has a useful side effect in promoting holiness and transparency. And I welcome that. I have many reasons to be faithful to the Lord. One of those is just the crushing thought of how awful it would be to my wife and family if I was not. The horrible thought of how sad it would be if everything that I've written would always be picked up with and there's a man who was once faithful. And so as I think about those things, I love the way in which the Lord has helped me to be more accountable by having people in my home who can watch what I do and how I speak. It's just one more guard.
I think you had showed me something a while back that you had written along those lines. And before that, I hadn't thought of it in those terms. And it really, really is powerful and wise, because when we think about pastoral failure, or just personal failure, it's easy to think, okay, we need accountability. I need to be in the Word. All that's true. But hospitality, there's no magic bullet. Sin will find a way. But we want to make those ways as difficult as possible.
Yeah,
and the hospitality shows, somebody was just saying recently, and thankfully I don't remember who he was talking about. It was something in the past, but was saying that people were reflecting, looking back, that before this person had a failure, he started to kind of tell more sexual jokes, more kind of innuendo, just got sort of freer and looser, and maybe the sort of thing that is a one-off, you're like, I don't know, maybe that was a little over the edge. And that's the sort of thing that if you're in with life, now we can always find a way to fake, I suppose, but the more you have people in your life, the more you actually have friends. There's a real, do you really have friends? Not just well-wishers, ministry colleagues, people who, mutual back scratchers, but real friends who see you, at the soccer game, the cross country meet, who see you in your home.
Yeah.
Lord, help us. Lord, help all of us. Chad, thank you for your scholarship. May the Lord give you many, many more decades to serve the church. Grateful for you, for Emily, for your kids. Thank you for all that you do and for your friendship. And look forward to having you teach me and others many more things about the Westminster Assembly.
Thank you, Kevin. Feelings are mutual. Glad to be on the show.
All right. Thank you all for listening or watching to Life and Books and Everything, a Ministry of Clearly Reformed. You get more episodes like this at clearlyreformed.org. Until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.